to Top Shelf at the Merritt Library with your host, Carol Ann Tack.
Welcome back to Top Shelf at Merritt Library. I am your host, Carol Ann Tack, and I have to say I have been on a lucky streak reading books that have just knocked me out. So get your pens ready to write about this latest title from author Tatiana Soli. First, I just have to give you a bit more information about our guest today. I know a lot of you readers out there are familiar with Tatiana's work. If you are not, you've got to get a hold of her not-to-be-missed books. Of course, titles like The Lotus Eaters, I know you know it, you didn't think you knew it, but you do know it, The Lotus Eaters, The Forgetting Tree, and The Last Good Paradise. We actually did a book discussion here of The Lotus Eaters a few years ago, so it's nice to bring Tatiana back into the library in this way for this incredible book. And some more bio. Tatiana's work has been awarded the UK's James Tate Black Prize, and she's been a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Award. Her books have also been twice listed as New York Times notable books. So for today's podcast, as I said, we're going to talk about Soli's latest book, The Removes, which is published by Sarah Crichton Books. I was very fortunate to get an advanced copy of this, and as usual, I'm passing it around to every librarian I can get my I can get it in their hands, and I made it an instant staff pick here. This book covers so much ground, and there's so much in here that my own description, it's impossible to do it justice. So I'll do the best that I can here. This piece, it's a piece of historical fiction. It's Native American history, and it's set in the American West during the time of the Indian Wars. We've got more than a few characters telling us their stories, but the reader focuses on General Custer, his wife Libby, and Ann Cummins, who's a 15-year-old girl abducted by the Cheyenne. So the story weaves through their lives during this time period, and the book is, it's pretty impossible to put down. I kept reading passages to my family. Listen to this part, listen to this part. So I'm sure my daughter's going to be very jealous that I'm having this conversation without her. The descriptive language presents images and levels of violence during the Indian Wars that some readers, like myself, we've guessed at this, but there's levels of violence during the wars that, like I said, we've guessed at. But the lush descriptive languages add cinematic vistas to the vast beauty of the country during this time period. It's got quick pacing, and as I said, it's told through several viewpoints. This is an incredibly compelling read, and I'm just going to stop right there because I'm tripping over my own tongue. And welcome, with the utmost pleasure, author Tatiana Soli to the Top Shelf at Merritt Library Podcast. Welcome, Tatiana.
Thank you for having me. What a great introduction. I don't know what to say anymore.
I know. Well, it's a pretty easy book to be effusive over. I really have to say that, and I can't thank you enough for taking the time away from your writing and your desk, and I am so grateful. I'm going to get right down to it. Please tell us, if you can, how this idea to focus on this particular time period, because I worry that the book will be classified as a Western, and it's not, it's a Western, but it's historical fiction, and I don't want it to get lumped into that category. I don't feel the Western's going to do it justice. Where did this come from? Why focus on this time period? What happened? How did this happen?
No, I appreciate you saying that, because to me, I'm trying to do a new take of the Western, or a stereotypical Western. So first of all, I'm focusing on female characters, but I look at it very much as telling the story of these characters, and it happens to be set in that time period. So I don't look at it as a Western, and I hope that people, you know, see beyond, you know, just the title of that. After Lotus Eaters, or during Lotus Eaters, I did a lot of reading in military history. That just seems to be an area that I'm drawn to, just for my own reading. And I read about the 7th Cavalry in Vietnam, and everybody knows they always talked about going out into Vietnam as Indian country. And so there were these little kind of things I didn't know what to do with, but when I read about the history of the 7th Cavalry, they were saying, of course, it was, you know, started by, you know, Custer back in, you know, Kansas in the 1860s. And at the time, I had the average ignorance about Custer. I basically knew, you know, that he had died at Little Bighorn, and I knew, you know, kind of from the movies that you see Little Big Man and everything, that he was just kind of like this crazy maniac out on the plains. And so when I was reading in the military history, some of these historians and military people were saying, you know, he was a brilliant tactician of the cavalry during the Civil War. He was a national hero. And then he goes out onto the plains, and they said, they talked about his, I guess you call it a memoir. He was writing about his experiences out on the plains. And they said he was much more nuanced. He understood his enemy. He understood the Indian tribes. He respected, you know, them as wonderful warriors. And he had a much more nuanced understanding of things out there than, you know, anybody would lead you to believe just from, you know, the popular stereotypes about him. And so then once I knew that much, I was, you know, starting to read everything I could just to figure out about him. And, you know, he's such a polarizing figure. I thought that's interesting that, you know, he definitely had flaws. He definitely did, you know, things, you know, he was an Indian fighter, but that was kind of the history of our country. So I thought he's a more interesting character than what we think. And so I was kind of on the line just reading it for myself. I didn't think I would write about it. And then they talked about his wife. And once I found out that he had a wife and he had this 12-year passionate marriage with this woman that he also, you know, was a philanderer and he cheated on. Well, that was the story, because their relationship was the beginning of being able to, it was like my key into that time period. And so from then on, it just kind of grew out of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. Like you had mentioned, and we both seem to be on the same page with that. You know the general history, the Battle of Little Bighorn, and you get this information about Custer, but this is something that it's so richly drawn, his character and his voice. And I'm thrilled that you provided a bibliography and some photographs, because as I was reading, and that's probably the librarian in me, I immediately went to search for pictures and anything I could find that would help me put a picture, a true life picture of what, I mean, we have a general idea of what he looked like, but to have him with his wife, to have Libby there was really, it was really surprising, and it gave me pause to actually see her, because I've been reading about her. So you were able, you did that, putting that together, again, it is so vividly drawn there. Where did the decision come to put the photographs in the book and some of the other material that's in there? Is that that's actual source material, it seems like?
Yeah, of course. I had done that with my first book on Vietnam. I had, you know, pictures all over.
Right, I remember that,
I had,
yeah,
newspaper articles. And so that's when I'm doing a heavily researched book, I'm just very visual myself. And so, you know, there are a lot of pictures of Custer. He took and had made sure a lot of pictures were taken of him.
It certainly seems that way, yes.
But for me, I always, when I had written a section or something, I always went back to the picture, and I found that, I don't know, it's kind of grounding, because once you're in a story, you kind of forget that these people were really alive and that this time period was really a real one, that this isn't a made-up one. And so I thought it'd be kind of exciting.
Okay, we lost our connection. We're just going to pause.
I'm sorry, are you okay?
Yep, we're there.
Traditional historical novel, I thought it was nice to have that transparency of you seeing part of my research and you having part of that experience of putting this story together in your own mind, part of your own experience, is that you're reading a made-up chapter, a scene or whatever, and then you can actually look at the pictures and realize these were real people. The documents are amazing because you just have to keep on reminding yourself it's so important that you not bring this period of time, 2018, back to that era. So when you read these documents, you're just shocked that these kind of things were put out by our government, that this was policy, that this was common attitude at that time. And so I think the juxtaposition of all of these things, it just makes it a richer experience, a historical experience.
Well, especially
you really understand that time better.
Especially that's the spreadsheet, I don't know what else you would call it, the Indian casualties spreadsheet. I mean, it's appalling and it's heartbreaking at the same time. You don't know. I didn't know what to do with that information. And it was shocking that everything I had just read is actually documented by this spreadsheet provided by the government. It was shocking. And Yeah, it was just.
And of course, people are the different people are telling you different, you know, body counts and everything, which is interesting because everybody is trying to skew the story for their own usage. So that's a very modern thing, actually, and it's interesting to try to use your doubt and your skepticism about today, put it into back into history also.
Oh yeah, for sure. What I love, and I think most readers will also love. So you get this whole Custer piece of it. But the strongest characters for me, of course, are Libby, which is Elizabeth Bacon, and she actually marries George Armstrong, who becomes General George Custer. And she does not want to get married. She's really not buying it, and she wants to do something different. And that's what I love about it. She's sort of thinking, well, she's resigned to it. She'd be more than happy to be, quote unquote, a spinster. And the spinsters that she knows and is exposed to have very full, rich lives. And of course, coming from her background, she's no choice. She has to get married. So she picks Custer. Or somebody picks somebody. I don't know. I don't know who picked who. And I can't get Libby's voice out of my head. She's conflicted, right? So she goes on the trails with him and she goes and spends a lot of time with him, but she also is terribly lonely back home waiting for him to come back. And she's trusting until she realizes something else is going on with respect to their marriage. When did Libby come to you? When did she cry out to you? I know you got the Custer piece of it. When did Libby sort of start speaking to you?
Well, getting involved in the research, once I found out that he was married, she actually wrote three memoirs, she wrote them after he died. She became a kind of lecturer. She went on the circuit. She wrote these books about their life because he was still, you know, very well known. And she kind of made him more well known afterwards. She lived 50 years after him. And so she wrote these books about their experiences. And the books are totally for public consumption. I mean, they don't talk about their real relationship at all. They're whitewashed and everything. But still, she's a fascinating character because women just didn't do that at that time. And the type of women that were adventurers and everything were not the type that she was. So she was very, you know, upper middle class, judge's daughter, only child. He had made sure that she was educated, so she went to a women's seminary. So she was the type of woman that would not go out to the Wild West and have these, you know, crazy, unprotected experiences. And she was married to a man that really, you know, he would have her ride out to meet him in camp. And it was dangerous for her to go out there. And yet she did it. And she never regretted it. She never changed her mind. And so she was just a fascinating character. And I liked the two different women because they're coming from two opposite ends of the kind of experiences that one would have out there. And so it gives you just this more wide idea of what life was like out there.
And I thought Custer was very confident that Libby would make it out to him without damage. So I don't know. Half of me kept thinking, well, does he want this to happen? I didn't know where to fall on my opinion of that situation. Or was he just thinking, oh, she'll be fine. She's a tough old girl. She'll be okay.
I think from what I've read, that's the way he was. He just was kind of that way about himself, and he was that way about other people. And I love that one thing where they would ride out and they'd race horses across the plains and everything. And she would say, like, you know, she was really scared of be doing that, but she had to do it because he expected her to do it.
He expected her to do it, yeah. I mean, they have a marriage, but it's more of a friendship. He really sort of relies on her emotional as a crutch, kind of. I mean, he tells her everything. He confides in her. He gives her a lot of information. I don't know.
Too much.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And then, of course, the stuff that she finds out later on. So we were talking about these two women characters. So then on the flip side of that, you have Anne. And Anne, she's 15. She's kidnapped by the Cheyenne with her sister. And then we get Anne's story. And her voice is just as clear as Libby's, and her experiences. Was she based on a historical figure? Were there historical writings that helped sort of flesh out how it was to be kidnapped?
Yeah, so I had the Custers, and I wanted to go into the tribes and you know, how can I write about that really? And I remembered the captivity narratives from college, and I was trying to figure out, well, will I have a white person who's living in the tribe, and how would they realistically be there, and what is their experience? And so then I started reading the captivity narratives, you know, with the idea of specifically of this story, so the ones that occurred during the Plain Indian times. And so before that, on the eastern coastal tribes, there was actually a barter trade in captives on the plains. I think during that whole period of time, there were maybe a couple hundred of captives taken. So because it's so much more land, because it's so much more spread out, because there's so many fewer people, but they still, you know, they had a fair number of you know, settlers that would be taken. And a lot of times they would kill the adults, but they would keep the children. And so I have her at the age, you know, for storytelling, so you can't be too young, otherwise it's too much of a time span. But to have her have that experience, first of all, it's an inside look at what the tribes were going through during that time, being pursued by the army all across the plains. But it's also about, you know, a woman's voice. And so when you read the captivity narratives, it's amazing because these are women that they weren't writers and they weren't making it up, but they actually, because the settlers and the people on the East Coast, they wanted to know, I mean, what in the world would it be like to be, you know, captured by the Apache? And so these women, when they were rescued, they would have a huge audience. And a lot of times they would have, you know, equivalent of ghostwriters, or they'd have a male who would write their story or something. And so they had, it was a way, you know, for them to come back to society, to have a, you know, some type of a career, to have money. And these were like bestsellers of their time. And so I read a bunch of them. They were, you know, none of them is exactly what happened to Anne. It was kind of a combination, and it was important. The most interesting thing, I mean, I knew what the captivity would be like, but what was so interesting to me is how many of them, once they were rescued, their lives did not get better at all. They either missed, because they had been so long in the tribes and they had assimilated, they missed that. Or the actual whites, you know, they looked at them as damaged goods. They were shunned. Their husbands would leave them. And a lot of them pretended it didn't happen. They'd move away. They'd never talk about it. And so that was just just one more interesting facet that I wanted to have happen for Anne.
And again, to your point, many of these women, if they were gone for a long period of time or kidnapped, they were so assimilated that coming back to society that they had once known was almost impossible for them. They chose to either stay, or like you said, when they did come back, their lives were, they were treated horribly. Their virtue was in question, and their morals were in question. And who wants to deal with that? Nobody, after being kidnapped and losing your family and your brothers, sisters, and watching these horrible things happen to your family members. And I love Anne at the end of the book. I mean, I think, and I don't want to give too much away, but I you know, you are with her through that. My heart was thundering when we got to the end with Anne. I mean, my heart was just thundering, and I was reading to my husband. He's like, put the book down. So because of this voice that we have, Anne, and we have Libby, there are other characters that really just speak volumes. Golden Buffalo. I loved reading about Custer's brother Tom. Neha, who is Anne's friend, becomes Anne's friend, and say the name
Monacita.
Monacita. Was she a real person?
She was a real person, and basically, what I have in the book is what I had found in research. You know, you just never know what things appeal to you. I didn't go any further than what is factually known. And there was, you know, a lot of controversy whether she really did have a child. The prevailing thought is that Custer was sterile from West Point. And so she did have a child. And so they, a lot of times they were thinking that it might have been Tom's child or not. None of that was as important. But what was interesting to me about it is during that time period, the Native American tribes and the army and the settlers, there was an intermixing. They lived side by side in different ways, and they would have, you know, cross. They would get to know each other in different ways. You know, some of them were violent, some of them became friendships. But as part of that assimilation, they weren't all living separately, and then they would suddenly see each other in battle. They were living side by side in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's something else. And even though she is a historical figure, Mona Sita, I had never heard of her. Didn't know that she had a relationship with Custer. A lot of this just came as, dare I say, news to me. Not obviously the battle of, you know, not those particular wars and those are the things. I mean, there's a lot of detail that's out there, but this other level of information, of historical information that we get in this book, really just knocked me over. I mean, there's a lot of information in there, and I was grateful to have it. So we talked about the characters. I also love that you put in the front of the chapters or the end of the chapters these actual missives from like Sitting Bull and some of the other chiefs of the time. Now, was that something that, because that's out there, or how did you dig through to find those particular pieces?
I mean, that is out there, and, you know, just doing the research, those were the pieces that were kind of the most moving to me, and
they
that
are.
they kind of give you, I don't know, it just gives you the emotional thing. I liked constantly going back and forth between the factual and the fiction and kind of having this rounded experience, because, you know, obviously when you're doing research, you're reading all nonfiction. And I wouldn't say this to my historian friends, but, you know, that's not enough for me.
Right.
I need the fiction too. But to have both together, I think, is actually perfect, because you actually, you know, have a real sense of these people. And then obviously the Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse and
their, and the
quotes,
negotiation,
you know,
process.
Important.
Yeah, that negotiation process where they're actually sort of negotiating in a positive way, and it's you want to cry out to them and say, this is not going to happen the way you think it's going to happen. There's just a lot of heartbreak in that when you read those missives, especially from both of them. There's a lot of heartbreak there. How did you make sense out of it all? I mean, it is a heartbreaking read. I know you had to go through a lot of source material. At what point did you find yourself with pages and pages and books sort of all around you and highlighting? And how did you sort of get it all to, well, I guess there's an easy enough timeline to follow. But you start out with Libby being single, getting pulled into her, that girdle thing that she's wearing, and then all the way to the end. It's a long journey, so you must have had a ton of source material to go through to sort of bring it down to where we are.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you could probably write a book twice as long, which you don't.
I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure.
But you kind of pick you pick through, you know, out of 10 scenes, you pick through the one that will give you the information. I mean, to me, it's just like, what did a woman like her at that time, you know, being put into these corsets and being wearing these absurd heavy dresses and having to be out on the plains where they're barely mobilized. It's not like they were in New York City or Paris where they had, you know, society, but they still tried to dress that way out there, the sense of, you know, being immobile and constriction, and the women couldn't go out of the house because they were afraid of being, you know, killed. Or being kidnapped. I mean, there was that real fear. So, I mean, it's dangerous. It's tempting to want to put in everything you learned, but you have to cherry pick. You have to pick it for the story.
But, and then the pieces that you do choose, it's Custer's going here, and then he comes back, then he goes here, and then they go to New York, which I cannot imagine going from where they were back to New York.
And that's interesting, because kind of like in your head, you're thinking, well, they're out there, and so they're always out there. But they had breaks, and they would go to New York City and you know, live it up for a couple of months.
Oysters, you know? and champagne,
yeah,
salons, and all of this.
Yeah, and they would say, oh, we're going back to the States, and in other words, you're going out to the territories, which is totally, totally primitive. So that was another interesting kind of thing, again, to think of that time period, is that, of course, it's isolated and lonely and there's no communication, but they did have enough where that they got out of there and they went back and they found out what their public, and that was very important to Custer, what their public persona was in the news and amongst the players back east. And, you know, that was very important for how he was trying to deal with the tribes at that time.
Yeah, and
trying to be successful.
He tries to sort of clear his name and say, this is really how it was. It wasn't like this. And that is such an interesting, that whole piece of it, of him trying to go back and do damage control to sort of unsully his name. I didn't think of it. It just never occurred to me that they would be, you know, that he would go back and say, well, that's not true. Let me set the record straight, kind of a thing. Yeah, and I'm getting, they would put on their finery and their clothing, fix their hair, and they'd go out and see the theater and they'd see the shows and such. Completely different from where they had just come from, right? So they're out in the territories. They're in the middle of, truly almost the middle of nowhere.
Exactly.
And then to go back to... to go back to New York. I guess it's for us, it's like going somewhere where there's no Wi-Fi, right? You're sort of, you're back in the, and we're all Luddites again. I don't know. I don't know. So tell me, I feel like I have 1,000 questions. Tell me about the title, though, of the, how does it come to be The Removes?
So that was from The Captivity of Mary Rowlandson. So that's one of the first bestseller captivity narratives. And so when I came across that one, she has each section of her abduction and her rescue numbered remove one, remove two, remove three. And she's very much, that was one of the earlier captivity narratives. So it's kind of like this experience happened to you and based on your faith and your belief in God, you will be rescued. So it was more of a straightforward captivity narrative. But I was just, I don't know, I found it so interesting. The Removes is biblical, the journeys, you know, each journey that she takes, the first one to be taken away and then to go further out and going with the Indians while they're trying to survive also. And then she goes back, you know, and is rescued. And so I thought it just appealed to me because it's kind of strange, but it's kind of, you almost understand it and you don't, it's mysterious. And it really applies to all three of the characters in different ways. You know, Libby and Custer go there on purpose. Anne is, you know, obviously she's the captive and she is not in charge of her fate at any point in there. And so it just seemed to work.
Yeah, it does. And because I kind of thought of it as, I kind of thought of it as they're getting further and further removed from where they were originally, where they originally started.
And their ideas of what their life is going to be like in the case of Custer and Libby.
Yeah, and I particularly like the title for that. Was that your title? Did the powers that be come up with extra? Like, did they have a different title in mind?
I had to fight for it a little bit.
Yay, good for you.
I thought it was a little obscure, but I like that you don't know exactly what it is right away and that you have to...
Right, and that's
that. Think about it a little.
When you get that slow reveal as you read it, you are so richly rewarded. At least I felt richly rewarded when I figured it out. I said, "Oh my gosh! Okay, I know what's happening here." Each transition Anne makes, she's removed from her original situation. Same thing with Custer. Same thing with Libby. I mean, you could even argue probably with that Golden Buffalo thought the same thing, or. Because he has his own transitions, and he was such a great character. I loved him. I thought he was just, I don't know why, I was reading him, and I thought, well, who would play him in the movie? I don't know why, he was really, he really came out to me. He was sort of a cameo. I just kept thinking of him as this cameo picture. And of course, Custer's brother, Tom, who even in the photograph in the book, he's a very handsome guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
They said that he was equal to Custer as far as being a soldier, and he was, you know, also a ladies' man, but he seemed a little bit nicer.
Yeah, he definitely.
He was the younger brother. He was a little sweeter.
Yeah, and I think Custer sort of felt like, well, now that he's the general, he has to come up with a certain persona, of which being nicer is not one of his jobs, mm-hmm. I guess. So So the book came out really recent, within the last 2 months, I think, 2 or 3 months. But again,
two
I read.
2 weeks, actually.
What's it?
2 weeks.
2 weeks. You know what? Because I read it as a galley. So for me, it's I have been living with it and questioning things about it for some time. The feedback's been amazing. You must be thrilled to hear like all these amazing reviews about it.
It's fun to go out and start sharing it with people because you live with it alone for so long. And this is, you know, a departure again from, well, I don't tend to do the same type of book, but you just never know how it's going to be received. And so I'm so excited about it, you know, and I've been in this world for so long. So it's fun to have it go out there.
Yeah, I bet. And there's, like I said, a lot of love here. We made it a staff pick. Another book discussion group here would like to do it as a book discussion. So that's always a sign of success for me. When we put the books out, the librarians kind of know that, oh, the book discussion ladies, they want it. So that's great. And we're thrilled about that because if we can push it that way in a positive way, then it's wonderful. Because this is just fresh, brand new, this new baby that's been delivered, is it too soon for me to ask if you're in the process of working on anything else? Is there a screenplay in your life? What's happening? Are you writing anything new?
I actually, during the editorial process, we kind of had a break, and I had started another novel before I got into this, and you know, I always think that I have such a clear idea of what I want to do that it's going to go faster, so this took a lot longer than I thought. So I have 100 pages of a novel that I had started, and I actually had done the whole 100 pages last summer, and so I'm going to go back to that, and that's a contemporary set in Iraq novel. So it's kind of about a soldier and the experience. So it's kind of like what I do, but it's a different time period.
Well, we will certainly look forward to that one. And this is a really good place to wrap things up because I don't want to take up any more of your time. I'm so appreciative. Thank you so much, Tatiana. I'm thrilled to have hosted you on Top Shelf. I really am. I appreciate the time you gave us away from your desk. That was awesome. Listeners out there, please check out The Removes, again, by Tatiana Soli. It is something else. Bring it to the beach, bring it wherever you're going, listen to it on audio. It is really terrific. So thank you, Tatiana. I appreciate
it. Thank you so much. It was fun.
That's it for today. I want to thank my listeners, as always, for choosing to spend your time with us today. You can find Top Shelf on iTunes, Google Play, and wherever you find podcasts. Also, don't forget, check out our website, merricklibrary.org, for all the latest and the greatest news about Merrick Library. We have a fabulous library, and there's always some good news and fun things happening. Special thanks, as always, to Library Director Ellen Firer and the Merrick Library Board of Directors for their continued support of this podcast. Thanks, guys. It's the best. I love doing it. I'll see you all next time. And you remember to keep us on your top shelf.